1 Samuel 17:55 to 19:24, the 14th talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on November 25, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be continuing in 1 Samuel. We'll finish up chapter 17. Move on. I'm planning to do a couple of chapters today, so quite a bit of material, but I think we'll be able to fit it all in and still have time for questions. 2 weeks ago, I talked about the story of David and Goliath. So that's where the action leaves off. Even if you weren't here, I'm sure you're familiar with the story. So we pick up in chapter 17 with verse 55. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner said, "By your life, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "You inquire whose son the youth is." So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." We've talked about this a little bit, but this is all now going back in time to when David apparently had just finished talking to Saul and offered to go out against Goliath single-handed. And Saul, apparently in that conversation, was very impressed with David's presence. He must have been impressed. He allowed David to go out and challenge Goliath. But after he leaves, Saul asks Abner, who is his right-hand man, a relative of Saul, he asks him, whose son is this? Who is this? And we've talked about this a little bit before. It sounds like Saul doesn't know this guy at all. And yet, in earlier chapters, we know that David has been coming on a regular basis to play the lyre whenever Saul has an episode, one of these episodes where he goes into these, he's very unsettled. And David plays the lyre, and it seems to help soothe him down. So Saul has been exposed to David. Saul knows who David is, at least to one degree or another. So it seems strange here that he would ask, "Whose son is he?" Now, in Samuel, there are a lot of places, quite a number of places, where it is difficult to put together the little pieces in the text. There are things that seem to be incongruous. And this appears to be one of those places. It seems to be inconsistent. And textual critics have a field day with this particular book, because if your assumption is that what we have in front of us is the result of different textual traditions that have been rather mechanically and unartfully combined, then of course you're going to have places where it's inconsistent and it doesn't fit together well. And if you are looking for those kinds of things, you will readily find them. You will certainly readily find them in 1 Samuel, but I would dare say you could find them in other works as well, most any other work. I am operating under the assumption that this is a coherent whole, and that even where it appears to be inconsistent and incoherent, that if we knew more, if we knew more background or whatever, that we could iron out those apparent problems and solve them. Now, having said that, 1 Samuel is problematic in that there are quite a number of textual problems, a lot of textual variants. Furthermore, the Masoretic text is considerably different from the translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek that was made about 300 BC, the Septuagint. There are significant differences between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. And so there's always the question, which variant do we go with? So I'm aware that there are all kinds of problems, but my assumption is that the apparent inconsistencies, if we work hard enough at them and if we knew enough, we could iron those out. In this particular case, I think that we can explain this apparent problem in that what Saul is asking here is for a different kind of information than that which he already has with respect to David. David has been coming to play the lyre for him, but there's no reason to think that Saul has interacted with David extensively and knows a lot about David and his background. What Saul is apparently interested in here is to know, what family does David come from? What is his social background? And as I understand it in Hebrew society at this time, there were families that were considered to be families of note, and then there were families that were kind of nobodies. And the question that Saul seems to be asking is David from one of these families of note? When I say a family of note, that doesn't mean that they're wealthy, because we know that David's family is not wealthy. But does he come from a significant lineage? Is apparently the question. And it's those people from significant lineage that are good candidates for service in the court. And David does come from, apparently, from a family of note. So that's what Saul wants to find out, and apparently he wants to find that out in order to know what kind of a position that David might ultimately end up with inside his administration. Abner doesn't know his background, so Abner says, well, I'll find out. So when after David has killed Goliath, he comes back to see Saul carrying a trophy. He's got Goliath's head in hand, and he stands before Saul, and I would suspect that there is a long conversation. I suspect that there's euphoria over what has just happened, and they probably talk about a number of things. The only thing that's recorded, however, is Saul finding out from David what his lineage is. And David responds, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. Next section. Now it came about, when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as well as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So apparently Jonathan, who we know is Saul's general under Saul, his son, but also a general under Saul, they work together. We've seen indications that they don't always coordinate their activities, but we'll see later on that they do work together. Jonathan may have been there when Saul and David had their conversation. And Jonathan approaches David, and Jonathan immediately senses a kinship with David. They are kindred spirits. And Jonathan, I think, senses that. Jonathan, as we have seen, is one who is intent on doing that which God wants him to do. He has a heart that is pure and faithful with respect to God. And I think he senses that same thing in David. And that's the point of attraction. Jonathan wants to enter into a covenant with David, that they will be friends and they will be loyal one to the other. This is at Jonathan's initiative, not at David. And we'll see throughout this chapter and next chapter that David is kind of swept along by events now for a while. And it's other people that take the initiative. So Jonathan wants to enter into a covenant with him. It's a covenant that we will see later. Both of them take very seriously. Jonathan, on his part, will take it very seriously, and David, on his part, will take it very seriously. And they make this covenant in a way that such covenants were made in ancient times, with an exchange of armor. We see that there's a scene in the Iliad where we have a similar kind of exchange talked about. So Jonathan strips off his robe and his weapons, gives them to David as a token of this agreement that they are entering into, that they will be loyal one to another. It's interesting here that Jonathan is not envious of David. And as we continue the narrative through, we'll see that there's no hint of jealousy on Jonathan's part. And in fact, Jonathan is the heir to the throne. And yet he is befriending this one, David, who will end up taking the throne after his father dies, Saul. And yet no indication of envy here. Then it indicates that David enjoys a position now under Saul, in which he goes out to war over the men of war. He will go out to battle with some soldiers under Saul's direction, and does well in that position, and finds himself favored by all of the people as well as Saul's servants. So every place David turns at this point, he's enjoying success, and God seems to be smoothing the way for him. Now in verse 6, we're going to go back in time a little bit. In verse 6 now, it's going to be talking about when they make their way from where the battle with Goliath happened to Gibeah, where Saul sits on the throne on a regular basis. Verse 6, "And it happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang as they played, and said, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his ten thousands.' Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, 'They have ascribed to David ten thousands, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?' And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on." So this is apparently right after Goliath has been killed. Saul and his court are making their way from the place where the battle had occurred back to Gibeah, where he generally sits on the throne. And as they're making their way back to Gibeah, they're passing through various Israelite villages and cities, and the women come out to meet them and to celebrate the victory that had just taken place. And they give praise to Saul, but they give greater praise to David. And Saul notices this. It says he became very angry, for this saying displeased him. You can imagine, Saul is already, as we've talked about, he's feeling like his hold on power is a bit tenuous. And he's concerned about it slipping away. And we have seen several indications of that. And as a result, he's always on the lookout for someone who might challenge his position, who might be a rival to him. And now, for the first time, we get an indication that he sees David as a potential rival, someone who could take his place, certainly in the hearts of his people, if not actually on the throne. So it says in 9, and Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. So this seems to mark the time from which Saul will continually look at David suspiciously and with concern. And that suspicion and concern will grow steadily. Next section. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual. And a spear was in Saul's hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as his commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. But David said to Saul, Who am I, and what is my life or my father's family in Israel, that I should be the king's son-in-law? So it came about at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Okay. We now have another incident in which Saul has one of his episodes, and David is playing the lyre, so he is continuing in that capacity, even though he has been given a promotion. He's continuing in this capacity of playing the lyre when Saul has these episodes. And it says an evil spirit, or a spirit of evil, literally, from God comes mightily upon Saul. We've talked about this before. Apparently he has these episodes where he is very troubled, and that's when the music seems to be helpful. In this case, Saul is not pacified by the music, at least not sufficiently pacified. He picks up a spear that's apparently at hand, and he throws it at David and misses David, fortunately. But these episodes must be very distinct. They must be episodes in which Saul is not himself. Because this happens twice. David apparently comes back and or continues to play, and it happens again. And we'll see later in the next chapter it happens yet again. So David knows that Saul is not himself, and that when Saul is having one of these episodes, that it can be dangerous. But David nevertheless does his duty and dodges the spear whenever it comes. It points out in verse 12, now Saul was afraid of David. So it started out as suspicion. Now it's turned into fear that he has for David. And so Saul decides, I know how to take care of this. I'm going to get rid of David. And he sends him out on the front lines fighting against the Philistines, probably hoping that David will die by so doing. But David doesn't get killed in the conflict. In fact, he is successful in everything that he does. And not only is he successful, but his fame grows. That the people, all of Israel and Judah, loved David. So he's just becoming more and more popular, which is the very thing that Saul is afraid of. That's the very thing that is of concern to Saul. Saul is very worried about the opinion of the people as a whole. He thinks that that is the basis of his power. But David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. Once again, God is smoothing the way for David. Everything works out well up to this point. Now, Saul decides to offer to David his daughter. If you'll recall, when Goliath was coming and standing before the people, before the Israelites, and challenging them, Saul offered a reward to whoever would go out and fight Goliath. And one of the parts of that reward was that he would give his daughter in marriage to whoever would do that. Apparently, this offer is making good on what he had promised earlier. So he offers to David his oldest daughter, Merab. Now, Saul is apparently afraid to kill David. He doesn't want to be the one who takes David's life, but he would like David to be eliminated. So he comes up with these stratagems whereby David will die, but Saul doesn't have to be the one who actually does the killing. In this case, we know that that's what he wanted to do. We have his thoughts. He's going to marry his daughter to David if David will do one more thing. And what is that one more thing? He needs to go out and fight against the Philistines. And if he does so, then Saul would let him marry Merab. And that is to get David killed. That's his intention. But David is reluctant to marry Saul's daughter. He says, "Who am I, and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law?" I think this is a serious concern on David's part. David's concern is that he is not high enough born, and he is not someone of great enough accomplishments to merit marrying into the family of the king of Israel. And I don't know if Saul is swayed by this argument, or if he's just disappointed that his stratagem has not worked, that David has not been killed by the Philistines. But in any case, when the day comes when Merab is supposed to be married to David, that instead of marrying David, he is given over to another man. And Saul does not make good on the promise. But things develop later so that David does end up marrying into Saul's family, and that's described in the next section. Now, Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. When they told Saul, the thing was agreeable to him. And Saul thought, "I will give her to him, that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David, "For a second time you may be my son-in-law today." Then Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David secretly, saying, 'Behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law.'" So Saul's servants spoke these words to David. But David said, "Is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed?" And the servants of Saul reported to him according to these words which David spoke. Saul then said, "Thus you shall say to David, 'The king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, to take vengeance on the king's enemies.'" Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, David rose up and went, and he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul. So his name was highly esteemed. So Michal, who is another daughter of Saul, she falls in love with David. And so now Saul sees this as another opportunity that he might be able to catch David, get David in a situation where David will risk his life and lose his life, which is what Saul is maneuvering for. So he says, "For a second time you may become my son-in-law today." So this is David's second chance to marry into the royal family. Then it says that Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David secretly, saying, 'Behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law.'" Apparently, Saul is trying to overcome David's reticence to marry into the royal family. So he sends his servants out to speak to David privately and urge him to take up this offer. But David's response is the same as it had been before. "I'm too poor. I'm lowborn. I haven't accomplished enough. I really am not good material to marry into the king's family." But Saul comes up with a way that he thinks that he can overcome this problem. David may not be able to pay the dowry. He may not have enough wealth in order to do that. And he may not be someone of accomplishment. But Saul says, "I won't require a dowry. All I want is 100 Philistine foreskins. That will count as a dowry, and it will make you a person of accomplishment." With this offer, David seems to be satisfied that he can, in good conscience, marry into the royal family. And so he and his men go out against the Philistines, and instead of the 100 foreskins that are required, they collect 200 foreskins within some kind of narrow time limit that's been placed on them. And they do it before the days had expired. So David collects the 200 foreskins. He brings them and presents them to Saul. And then he ends up, he marries Michal, the daughter of Saul. Once again, Saul's stratagem has backfired on him. Not only was David not killed, but now David has married into the royal family. Now David is in a position to make a claim on the throne that he would not have been in a position to do otherwise. And Saul sees that his daughter genuinely loves David, and I think that probably makes it more difficult for Saul to maneuver, because anything he does to David is going to be harmful to his daughter, and therefore difficult for him. So Saul is in more and more of a tight bind here, and I think that he feels that very keenly. It says, Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. And we will see from here on out, generally speaking, that Saul is trying to get David. Then the end of this chapter, it just says that David goes out against the Philistines on a regular basis. So apparently he has become a general, is going out often, and whenever he goes out against the Philistines, he is successful. He seems to act more cleverly than the other Israelite commanders. And that is noticed by the Philistines, as we will see later on in the narrative. And it is noticed by the people in Saul's court. So his name was highly esteemed. So Saul is losing this popularity contest that has developed between him and David. Next section. Now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now, therefore, please be on guard in the morning, and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I find out anything, then I shall tell you. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter, so that they fled before him. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul, as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. And Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, so that he stuck the spear in the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. Okay, so now we have the first indication that outside of these episodes, that Saul is actively out to kill David. He's told his servants that they are supposed to put David to death. Jonathan, who is an advisor of Saul, finds out about this, is very concerned. This is an escalation now in what Saul has been doing. So Jonathan says to David, go hide. We'll get this cleared up. We'll see if this is just another bit of temporary insanity on Saul's part, or whether this is a settled and determined decision on Saul's part. So he says, David, go hide in the field, and I will come out into the field with my father, and I will have a conversation with him there so that you can hear Saul's own words, and you can see what the situation is for yourself. So David does so. David goes out in the field and hides. I'm not sure exactly where this is that he's hiding. But Jonathan comes out with Saul, and Jonathan has a conversation with his father. And the conversation is, Father, you've got things out of perspective. You don't understand who David is. You have misread his motives and his actions. You are suspicious of him, but he has been nothing but loyal towards you. He has done nothing but benefit you and the people of Israel. In fact, he killed Goliath. All of which, in principle, was to your benefit, and you should see it that way. Therefore, David is absolutely innocent. Why would you be after him? Why would you want to kill him? And apparently Saul is at least temporarily sobered by this and realizes, yes, you're right, there's no reason why I should be so suspicious of David. And as a result, David is allowed, comes back into the palace, continues to serve as he had served before, all based on Saul's promise that when Saul said, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. But David comes back. We don't know how much time passes between this and the next spear-throwing incident. But it could have been a long time or it could have been a short time. But that point that Saul had reached, where he understood and agreed with Jonathan's perspective that David has been a loyal servant to him, that has passed. And why did that pass? Because once again there's warfare. David goes out against the Philistines, leading the Israelite army against the Philistines, and once again is successful against the Philistines. He defeats them with a great slaughter, and they fled before him. So one more time, David is overwhelmingly successful, and the jealousy of Saul rises to the fore again and clouds his vision, and he can no longer see David as a faithful servant of his anymore. So, during another one of Saul's episodes, once again, David is playing the lyre, and Saul is overcome with rage towards David, and he picks up a spear and he flings it at David, trying to pin him to the wall. But for at least the third time, David escapes and is not hurt by it. So we see here, this is a repetition of what we've read about in the previous chapter. This is Saul's hatred, it's suspicion, jealousy, and hatred all coming lumped together. It kind of ebbs and flows. And it's in these episodes where it's the trickiest. But it doesn't go away. And we see it coming back here. Next section. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death." So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. And Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. She said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me on his bed, that I may put him to death." When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed with the quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this, and let my enemy go, so that he has escaped?" And Michal said to Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I put you to death?'" So now Saul is determined to put David to death, and we'll see from here on out, Saul is consistently trying to find a way to kill David. He sends his messengers to David's house to keep an eye on him so that David can't leave the house. And apparently the plan is to take him in the morning, arrest him, and present him before Saul and have him killed. Michael finds out about this. I don't know whether Michael heard something about it in the court or whether she looked out the window and saw some guys in trench coats standing on the corner. But there's something that clues her that things are dangerous, things are ominous. So Michael takes action. So once again, it's not at David's initiative that this happens. It is initiative taken by others, and in particular, it's initiatives taken by children of Saul. It's Saul's own children that are siding with David and trying to protect him in these incidents. She says, you gotta go right away. You can't wait till morning. You've got to get out of here. It's obviously a very dangerous situation for David, and Michael understands that. So she lowers him out of a window, like the spies in the story of Rahab and Jericho, where she let the spies out the window. Well, here Michael is letting David down through the window, and he escapes, and he takes off. He runs for his life. Meanwhile, Michael has to pull off a deception in order to allow David time to escape. So she takes a teraphim, the teraphim, the household god. She takes it, and it must have been big because this is taking the place of David. Sticks it in the bed where David would have been sleeping, puts clothes on it, and puts something over its face. So that when the agents of Saul look in, it will appear as though David is still there. They come in. The messengers finally come in. This is apparently morning when this happens. They come in, and she says, oh, David's sick. So the messengers return to Saul with that message that David would like to come to his execution, but unfortunately he's not feeling up to it. Saul says, I don't care if he's sick. I don't care what his temperature is. Go back, and this time bring him bed and all and before me. So they go, and they discover it isn't David at all. It's this stone idol that's been put in his place. So Saul asks Michael, well, what have you done? Why is it? Why did you help him to escape? And instead of, she is not truthful here, instead of telling the truth, she makes up an excuse and says that David made her do it, that David told her, according to her, why should I put you to death? In other words, David threatened her with death if she didn't allow him to escape. I don't know what to take, what to make of Michael in this particular episode. The first thing that's interesting is that she is really devoted to David. She's devoted to David above her devotion to her father. She wants to help him escape. She's doing everything that she can to do so and takes initiative to do so. She makes time for David's escape by pretending like David is in bed and using a teraphim. Curious, why is a household idol in the house of Michael and David? And I'm not sure whether it's in their household or whether she got it from nearby or exactly where it came from, but it's interesting that there would be an idol in this household. Just as a point of interest, I don't know what to make of this, but there are a number of parallels between this incident and Jacob and Rachel. Remember, Jacob had to work for Rachel. Laban said, work for me 7 years and I'll give you Rachel for a wife. And then later, he upped what Jacob had to do in order to earn Rachel's as a wife, just as David had to kill Goliath and then later come in with 100 foreskins. There are other parallels too, and I think that they are intentional. I just don't know what to make of them. There is some kind of connection being made here, I think, between those two incidents. But in that incident as well, you'll recall, Rachel had stolen the household idol from Laban. And she took it, and then when they were searching all of the tents to try to find it, she was sitting over it and claiming to be indisposed and therefore couldn't be moved in order to search carefully where she was sitting. Once again here, a household idol is being used as a deception. And then how she explains this, explaining this, her actions with a lie rather than telling the truth is interesting. And then Michael will show up later in the narrative, and I think we'll have occasion to come back to this. Next section. Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naioth. And it was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah." Then Saul sent messengers to take David. But when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And when it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came as far as the large well that is in Sekku. And he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah." And he proceeded there to Naioth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And he also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? David is clearly fearing for his life. He is let out of the window of his house, and he takes off running. And he runs to apparently the only place nearby where he thinks that he might be able to find security. He runs to Samuel. It's not too far from Gibeah to Ramah. I think it's like 5 or 6 miles. So he runs to Samuel. And when he arrives there, he tells everything that has happened to Samuel. And I'm sure Samuel understands clearly the gravity of the situation. Remember that ever since the last incident where Samuel and Saul talked, there's clearly tension between the two. And Samuel feared for his life, was afraid that Saul would have him put to death. So Samuel is obviously concerned and understands that this is a very grave situation. And Samuel, when David comes to him, is presiding over a company of prophets prophesying. And I'll talk about this a little bit more later. So Saul finds out that that's where David is, and he sends messengers to go and get David to bring him back. He sends messengers, they go, and instead of arresting David, they end up prophesying, and apparently as a result of their prophesying, they are unable to fulfill the command that had been given them. So Saul sends a second group of messengers. The same thing happens, then a third, and the same thing happens. So Saul decides they're all incompetent. I will go. And Saul goes towards Ramah. And as he, when he gets near Ramah, he asks where Samuel and David are. And they tell him that they are at Naioth, which is apparently a part of that, of Ramah, a part of that town, a section of that town. And as he goes there and is on his way there, Saul starts prophesying as well. And he is prophesying apparently all the way to Naioth, to when he gets to the presence of Samuel. And when he arrives there, he takes off his outer coat. When it says that he stripped it off his clothes, and then later it says he lay down naked, it doesn't mean stark naked. It doesn't have to mean that. It can mean basically without his outer garment on. So it's not as naked as we might think. But in any case, he's prophesying. He takes off his outer garment, and he stays there all day and night, and then apparently leaves, not having accomplished the purpose for which he had come. Okay, I would like to tell you what's going on with respect to the prophesying that's being talked about here and the school of the prophets. I don't know that I can. I read quite a bit in several books about the prophets in the Old Testament times, and there are as many opinions as there are books on the topic. I think the fact is we don't know a lot. All that we know is what we can glean from the books in the Old Testament. There are, in the ancient world, there were prophets in the other cultures, but those vary from one culture to the next as to what they did and what they were all about. And it's not clear that the prophets in the Old Testament are really quite the same thing. But I'll tell you what I think is happening here as best I can, but this is obviously something that you will have to work out for yourself. A prophet in the Old Testament, the main purpose of a prophet is what's called, it's not so much foretelling. We usually think about a prophet as telling us what will happen in the future. But that doesn't seem to be the root meaning of the Hebrew word, nor does it seem to be the practice, the main object of the Old Testament prophets. But rather it's forth-telling, is the way that they sometimes put it in some of the books. It is relaying God's message to man, to other people, either large groups of people or it can be an individual. But the prophet's job is to relay God's message to other people. A prophet is not an office. It's not on the flow chart of positions in the administration of state, but rather it's a function. And people function as prophets, or they don't function as prophets. The people function that way. They are called by God, and they can be used over an extended period of time by God in that capacity, or for just one occasion. It is all up to God as to how a prophet is used. Some prophets serve in this function willingly, some unwillingly. Some resist it initially. The message that they receive comes in various forms. It apparently can be an audible voice from God that other people can hear. That happens on occasion. Other times, it can be a vision. And other times, it seems to be an inaudible voice. But it comes to the prophet in a way that the prophet can tell that it is indeed God speaking to them. Now, at this early stage, the time of Samuel, there apparently were schools of prophets. And it's not clear what this is, communities or schools of prophets. It was the case in some other cultures that someone who served as a prophet was trained in that capacity. It's possible that that's what's going on here. It just seems unlikely to me that someone is trained to be the person that God designates to carry out this particular function, but maybe there is training involved in this. The other possibility is that these schools are composed of people who also have the gift of prophecy who gravitate towards some leader. Another possibility is that these are people who gravitate to someone who is a prophet because they want to learn from this person. They want to learn the wisdom that this prophet has to offer. And with respect to Samuel, it seems to me that that is a likely possibility. Samuel has been distinguished by his wisdom and judgment over a long period of time. And it seems highly likely that there would be people that would come around and want to learn from him. Whatever brings them together, whether they are gifted as prophets or not, apparently on occasion, these people within the school of the prophets have ecstatic experiences of some sort. And I don't really understand what these are. The leader of these schools is sometimes called a father. And that helps make sense of a passage that comes earlier in Samuel. We talked about it when we came to it. It's Samuel 10. And this is another incident in which Saul prophesies. This is right after Saul has been anointed by Samuel. And let's see, let me read part of this. Samuel, after he had anointed him, told Saul three things that would happen to him. And Saul went out, and all of those did come about. Let's look at 1 Samuel 10, starting with verse 9. Then it happened when he turned his back to leave Samuel, God changed his heart, and all those signs came about on that day. When they came to the hill there, behold, a group of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him mightily, so that he prophesied among them. And it came about, when all who knew him previously saw that he prophesied now with the prophets, that the people said to one another, "What has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man there answered and said, "Now who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" When he had finished prophesying, he came to the high place. So here is another incident in which Saul goes out and he prophesies, and he meets with a group of other prophets prophesying. It could be the same group. It could be this group that has gathered around Samuel. But someone watching says, "Who is their father?" And presumably that means, who is the leader of this school of prophets that this group is coming from? So apparently Samuel has this group of this school of prophets. And I think it's people who have come to learn from Samuel, learn from his wisdom. And occasionally they have some kind of ecstatic experience. And on two different occasions, Saul has been in the midst of them, and Saul himself has prophesied and had one of these ecstatic experiences. These two instances in which Saul prophesies, it seems to me, are are bookends. And it's important to take note of these bookends in Saul's life. The first one in chapter 10 occurs when he has just been anointed. He has the Spirit of God. And soon after this event of prophesying happens, Saul leads the Israelite armies in victory over the Philistines. In this second one, the Spirit of God has just departed from Saul. And on this time, Saul wanted to go and capture David, arrest him, and bring him back and put him to death. And the prophesying stands in the way of him accomplishing what he set out to do. So I think we're seeing, in the first instance, the ascent of Saul, and here we're seeing the descent of Saul. That Saul his life is falling apart on him. It's disintegrating. Saul is becoming crazier and crazier. His episodes where the spirit of evil comes upon him are more violent, and even when he's not having the episodes, he seems to be losing his touch on reality. But it's interesting that his craziness resembles closely being filled with the Spirit. In one of the incidents where he threw the spear at David, it says that Saul raged. But the verb that's used there is the same verb as to prophesy. And we'll see later that David, in order to get away from the Philistines, feigns craziness. So the whole narrative is getting kind of, it's raising the question of what is genuine and what is not genuine, what is false, what is true and what is false. But Saul is losing track of reality. He is becoming genuinely more crazy, and he can't see things clearly. He can't tell who his friends are and who his enemies are. That he imagines that David is his worst enemy, and yet David has been very loyal to him. He thinks that his children, Jonathan and Michael, will be loyal to him, and yet they side with David. All of his stratagems that he tries, they backfire on him. Everything's kind of falling apart in his hands, just crumbling in his hands. And it just keeps getting worse. It's interesting to me that that Saul here is not stupid. His stratagems all make a certain amount of sense. It's just that they don't turn out the way that he thinks they will turn out. God is at work undermining his efforts, just as God is at work making David prosper in everything that he does, which is in keeping with God's strategy, I think, in general, of guaranteeing that we in our rebelliousness will fail in trying to accomplish our goals. If you think about this, though, if you're a contemporary with these events, and you ask yourself the question, whose life is falling apart here? One might answer that it looks like David's life is the one that's falling apart. All of a sudden now, David is running for his life. And this was a very alarming situation. You can look at Psalm 59, which was written on this occasion. David genuinely feared for his life and thought that he would die. I find this interesting because you can't tell from circumstances whether a person's life is disintegrating or whether it's stable and coming together. Because if you were to take this snapshot, it would look like Saul is in the ascendancy. He's in power. He's got David on the run. But as we know from the narrative as it continues, and from the help that we've received from the narrator, we can see that in fact Saul's life is indeed falling apart and disintegrating. David's life, on the other hand, looks like it's falling apart. But in fact, we know from the hints that the narrator has given, and we know about as the narration continues, that David is going to win out. So the circumstances themselves aren't a reliable measure of whether we're looking at disintegration or whether we're looking at trying times. And the issue, the most important question is, where is one anchored? On what is one trusting? And it becomes increasingly clear that Saul is trusting in his stratagems, and he's trusting in this thing and that thing, and none of them work. None of them are something that you want to use as an anchor point. David, on the other hand, is truly anchored in his trust in God. He is trusting that God will be faithful to him regardless of what happens. And that is the core around which an integrated life can happen. And things look bad, but things are not disintegrating with respect to David. Okay, little time, questions.
There seems to be a distinct relationship between distinction between the relationship of people have towards power between a godly person and an ungodly person. And if you look at kind of the biblical heroes, I mean, or even in this instance, I mean, Saul is powerful. His relationship to power is to get him where he wants to go. Saul uses power to get what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
When power is offered to David, he avoids, I don't want to be the son-in-law, I don't want to, you know, mm-hmm. It's just like, and so the only time he uses power, i.e. Conquering Goliath, is when he sees, oh, power is going to be used to get God where he wants to go. And my relationship to power is that it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to God, and should he offer it to me, it's to accomplish what God wants to accomplish and not what I want to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think about that in my own life, you know, as a parent where I'm powerful, or as an employer where I'm powerful, I think we all need to kind of handle power carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a parent, if my goal is to gain respect from my children and to get them to tell other people what a great dad I am, then I'm going to discipline the kids in a way that's convenient to me. In other words, if you've inconvenienced me, then you're in trouble because you're messing with my power base. But if I use power loosely and I say, well, God has given me power over these children temporarily, I should use that power to feed them, to clothe them, to teach them right from wrong, to care about them because I realize that this power doesn't belong to me. And lastly, because power belongs to God, even those who abuse power set traps that they fall into themselves, and God's ultimate purpose for his power is to get done what he wants to get done. It always gets done, whether mm-hmm. we use or abuse his power. His power always accomplishes what he wants it to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Power is a gift from God, which is to be used in his service. And if we lose track of that, then we're abusing power. Anytime we lose track of that, whether it's power, wealth, anything that is gifted to us like that, it's to be used in the service of God.
And I think it shows a definite sign as to whether someone's a godly person or not a godly person based on how they handle power.
I think that's true. What But as the circumstances, things can look like they fall apart. So you can't tell from the circumstances necessarily whether the power is being used rightly or not. But it's how one actually thinks about that power and how one actually acts, not the success of those acts.
Hi. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. His question relates to mine a little bit, not mm-hmm. so much, but how you said, in some sense, the overall narrative is about, you know, what is true and what's not, mm-hmm. In the sense of, you know, Saul prophesying, but it not being, you know, true prophecy. And I had heard when I was at La Brie a definition of how you can tell when a prophet is true, which was different than the one you gave. And I liked what you said about what a prophet is someone mm-hmm. who's taking, you know, God's word or God's message and giving it to the people, mm-hmm. as opposed to someone who's predicting the future. But there's one passage in the Bible that someone had quoted to me that the one definition of how you tell a true prophet is that what they prophesy comes to pass.
Right.
And I would just be interested in, well, I sort of have two questions, but the, you know, how you would tell when a prophet of God is true, and then this is just sort of a personal question for me: is could there be prophets today? And mm-hmm. if so, again, that the first question would be relevant to that: is how you tell if right. someone's truly prophesying right. from God?
Right. The predictive. Statements within prophecy apparently are generally used to authenticate the message. So the purpose of a prophecy is not to tell people what's going to happen in the future. It's to deliver God's message to the people. But one way of indicating that that does indeed come from God is if it accurately predicts what will happen in the future. Therefore, someone who claims to be a prophet should be 100% correct with respect to the things that they predict about the future. Because if they aren't 100% correct, it didn't come from the God who is the master of history. But not all prophets give predictive claims. And how does one know when a prophet is indeed a prophet from God? That is a great question. And I have been thinking about that for some time, which doesn't mean that I have the answer to it. But I am truly struck by reflecting on the reception that Jesus received when he came. That a lot of people didn't recognize him for who he was. And he was the prophet of all prophets. Why was it that so many people didn't recognize him when he came? It is curious to me that the best students of the Bible are the ones who most consistently missed him. And why, and I'm talking about the Pharisees, why did the Pharisees miss him? Because in their study of the Bible, they weren't looking for the right things. They were looking for details with respect to where the Messiah, various details about signs of what would designate the Messiah. And they created this picture of what the Messiah would be, and they were looking for that, something that matched that picture. Whereas what they should have been doing is they should have been focusing on what kind of God is it that we serve? What kind of God is it that's described in the Old Testament? What is his character? Such that his messenger would have the same character and I could identify him by the character rather than superficial kinds of clues. I think that's why they missed him. And I think that's important for us because what we need to do is be focused on what kind of God is God? What is his character? Because no matter what the external trappings are, that should be identifiable. And I think that's helpful in thinking about how would you determine who is a true prophet. And I think the message, and I think even the spirit in which the message is given, should be consistent with the character of the God that sent this person. That there should be something about the way that the prophet is conducts himself and what he says that you say, yes, that's entirely consistent with the God, with the character of the God that I know. The reason this is of concern to me and interest to me is because I don't know much about end time prophecies, but it has occurred to me that if someone were to come along who could perform signs, I think the vast majority of human beings would find that very compelling, no matter what the message is. That just being able to do wondrous things would be, people would say that that person must be divine or representative of the divine. And if that's true, I think we've set ourselves up for a fall, because we're going to have to be more discerning than that. We need to be able to tell what is representative of God and what is not representative of God. And in order to be able to do that, we really need to understand well what kind of God it is that the Bible is presenting to us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We need to stop. Thanks.